So,
okay, good morning, everybody, and welcome to Chatting Between Takes, Season 2, Special Drop, Conversations with My Father. Dad, how are you doing this morning?
Fine, lovely, indeed. How are you?
I'm well, actually. I went and did some voice recording for my TV show and came over here to join you for lunch and a podcast.
What's that TV show about?
This one's called Tiny Pretty Things. It's on Netflix, and I basically play the head of a ballet academy.
Oh.
Bunch of teenagers who are trying to make it in the ballet world. It's based on a novel. There's a lot of intrigue around it.
Yeah.
And it's going to be out realistically next September. It's the first time people are going to get to see it.
Wonderful. One of my favorite, as you know, genres, ballet. I love it. And of course, we have a ballet dancer in the family.
We do.
Annalie,
my sister-in-law.
And I wrote two ballets into two of my operettas. So
so did you put those in just because you love ballet or because you felt they were most appropriate to the expression?
Felt they were appropriate. They had to be there, I felt. No, you wouldn't write something in just because you liked it.
Well, I did with Barn Wedding. We had this central scene between Kelly and Emily that we had found in an acting class. And when we started to construct our story, I said, I just need a dance in here. Like, I have to have a dance number. So as we created the requirements, now it was a wedding, so obviously it was no problem. But I did that without any link to any reason for it, just because I wanted to do it.
Yeah, but the reason for it, I'll reveal it to you now.
Okay, good. Tell me why I did what I did.
Your unconscious was saying it's a wedding, therefore people dance at weddings, and therefore you wrote that scene in.
Well, I don't think you're totally wrong. I also think my influences that I grew up with were so... I mean, Singing in the Rain was fundamentally probably the greatest influence of my childhood movie.
But also, you danced for 15 years as a ballet dancer, so...
But I think about it more filmically. I was thinking more of like half the reason I became a performer is Gene Kelly in Singing in the Rain. Okay, actually, Dad, this pivots us beautifully into actually one of the first questions I want to ask you. And this one is... So there's a young artist, she's 17 or 18, named Billie Eilish, and she's brilliant, and she's one of the most popular artists in the world. She wins, you know, the American Music Awards and Grammys and that kind of thing. Her brother, named Phineas, is incredible. Side note, the two people I was living with in Los Angeles, Sam and Monica, directed and choreographed all of Phineas's videos lately. And anyways, the point is that it's a... They're 20 and under, and they're brilliant. So they were on a talk show, or Billy was last night, and didn't know who Van Halen was. Like, literally didn't know the band Van Halen. So Twitter's having a lot of fun with that. And you've got all the different age groups going, she should know who Van Halen is. Who gives a shit if she doesn't? So here's my question for you, Dad. I'm thinking more about film than music. What films would a younger person not know that they should know? I'm not saying people should know Van Halen. Mm-hmm. Who gives a shit? Like it or not.
Yeah.
But what films are you like, listen, I get that you've got digital, I get that you've got streaming, but you should sit down and watch ...
Oh, that's a good question.
I'm good at questions, Dad.
I'll tell you.
That's why we're so good on the comedy.
Well, there's a number, I think. One of the ones I'd say right off the top of my head, a great one, is right in the area we were talking about, ballet.
Yes.
And it's called The Red Shoes, done in Britain just after the Second World War, about the late 1940s.
Okay.
And funny enough, it's a movie that Margaret Atwood said that was very influential in her life.
Okay.
And why? Because at the center of that story, which is about ballet, the young woman Moira Shearer is the dancer of the ballet, and she falls in love with a young composer and orchestra conductor.
Okay.
And then the impresario based on the famous historical guy called Diaghilev, the ballet Russe.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, he says, no. He said, art is the important thing. You cannot have another man in your life. There's only one love. It must be ballet.
And was he just gaslighting her because he loved her?
No. He meant that. And so
she's
got a choice. Will she then just be the wife to the composer whom she loves deeply, or will she go back to dance which she loves deeply? Anyway, she goes back to the dance, but then the red shoes destroy her, symbolic, in other words, that she commits suicide. So it ends up tragically. And of course, why did that influence Atwood? Because it was that choice, you see, the feminist choice. Do you want to be go on with your career?
Okay.
Or do you want to be a housewife just staying at home, as was always the pattern in the 30s, 40s, 50s? You know, you married a guy and that was it, you know.
So without spoiling too much of the movie, or maybe, is the idea in the movie that she shouldn't have pursued the art, or is the idea that she should have, but it might consume you regardless?
It leaves it open to you whether you say, I mean, why did she just settle down with a guy? But it was presented in very stark terms, because as we know, it is possible to combine an artistic career with marriage. But it was put in stark terms. It has been always, you know, art or life, very, very often.
Well, I think that is a huge one. By the way, I'm going to read you this quote that I don't know if we've talked about, and I want to get your opinion on it. So Agnes DeMille was, a letter was written to her by Martha Graham.
Yeah, and she was the great ballet instructor.
Yeah, and Martha Graham basically reinvented dance, essentially, the mother of modern dance. So she wrote this letter to Agnes DeMille, who was struggling.
Yeah.
And she said, there is a vitality, a life force, a quickening that is translated through you into action. And because there is only one of you in all time, this expression is unique. If you block it, it will never exist through any other medium and be lost. The world will not have it. It is not your business to determine how good it is, nor how valuable it is, nor how it compares with other expressions. It is your business to keep it yours clearly and directly, to keep the channel open. You do not have to believe in yourself or your work. You have to keep open and aware directly of the urges that motivate you. Keep the channel open. No artist is pleased. There is no satisfaction whatever at any time. There is only a queer divine dissatisfaction, a blessed unrest that keeps us marching and makes us more alive than the others.
Wonderful quotation.
What do you think?
Yeah. Well, I love it because it's a highly romantic definition, of course, of the role of the artist.
We love romance in this living room.
Yeah. But it's not romance. It's the romantic notion. Yeah. And in it, what she's really saying is there that the wind bloweth where it listeth, from the Bible, that you are an actor and that you have nothing to do with the whole thing, that you are merely an instrument through which art as a spirit, pneuma, the Holy Ghost, in the form of a dove, comes down and inspired the apostles to go out and preach the word, etc. And so an artist is, in a sense, a captive of the divine inspiration that comes along and propels him, her, to do their thing.
I agree.
She's saying. On the other hand, I would qualify that romantic notion by saying, I know many artists, even performing artists, who have been able to combine a career and in opposition to the romantic idea of the artist being like a nightingale singing its soul out there blissfully alone, that woman whom you see in the stage dancing, acting, singing, etc., etc., can also be a housewife with children and a husband.
Well, so
ideas which are antithetical to the romantic idea of the lonely artist in a tower.
Sure. I also think that I think that's a narrow picture of what the family could look like. But it's one picture of what could be satisfying off the stage. Mm-hmm. But I agree in both senses. I agree that you can have a fulfilling life with whatever satisfies you, but that the art journey itself has the dissatisfaction. You know, the number of times I'll shoot a scene with somebody who's wonderful, and you can see that vibration in them that they have no idea what they just did. Usually the best work, at least for me as an actor, you can't quantify it. If I tell you how my scene went, I was too conscious within it to be working in the moment.
Oh,
and
what
that means is, when I do my best work, I will probably be dissatisfied with the work. Now, I'm not talking about the life in general, because I actually agree with you. I think that me having a full life outside of my career, actually, especially as a guy in his 40s now, not an angry 20-year-old trying to knock down walls, different kinds of walls that I'm trying to knock down now. The point being is that the better a life I have outside, and I don't necessarily even mean more financially successful, although base needs met, the more I have to offer my art. However, within the art, I do believe that we just keep marching with this blessed unrest.
Oh, we are. Your blessed unrest. I would rephrase it another way, but giving you back a quotation. You've given me that quotation. I give you another one.
Okay, do.
In a wonderful poem, Coleridge talks about, he uses the line, "Weave a circle round him thrice, for he on honeydew hath fed and drunk the milk of paradise."
Ooh.
And he's really, that's the artist who is sacred, because he has drunk the milk of paradise and he's nothing to do with it. He's just that instrument, and he's been inspired, etc. And that corresponds very much to what you were talking about in the Agnes de Mille's thing there.
Sure. So, and, you know, I don't want to aggrandize my own chosen profession or yours, because we're both artists. But there is a reason why, you know, I believe, by the way, a movie like Endgame is utterly artistic. And you and I have always talked about this, that commercials are one of the highest art forms there are.
Oh.
It has to be current. In 30 seconds, you have to capture people's imaginations, hearts, and wallets all at once. That's an art form.
Oh, yeah.
You know, I love the way you always used to present that, because we've always talked about how much we like art and commerce. My point being is that if everybody in the world effectively, no, first world, but you know what I'm getting at, goes and watches the Marvel series,
mm-hmm.
there's a draw to that light.
Right.
That the flicker of that campfire and the men and women who stand in the center of that campfire, they truly are tapping into something, we'll call it universal.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And I do think there is something about that. And it doesn't negate any other profession. But there is something about when an artist can strike the center, the chord that people hear, and they all come from near and far to hear more of it,
mm-hmm.
there really is something divine in that.
Oh, absolutely. For instance, in Ireland, the kings always had, in the ancient times, they always had a poet by their side. He would be probably that poet, usually a man, would be, I would say, among the three most eminent people in the kingdom. Why? Because the poet celebrated the king. He kept records of the genealogy.
Sure.
All of those sacred, wonderful things. So the poet, the artist, was very, very important.
Absolutely.
Still is.
Okay, so let's bump to one of my Instagram followers, Sally Singing. Hey, Sally, what's going on? Just very simply for you, what's next? Are you doing another book? What's up? What are you working on?
Well, actually, funny enough, just this morning, I noticed there was a Twitter from Margaret Atwood saying, oh, there's a new book just came out on a writer, on a Toronto millionaire called Ambrose Small. And she said, I'd never heard of this guy, but he was a millionaire who disappeared.
She tweeted this today.
She tweeted that yesterday, actually.
You haven't filled her in on your project, apparently.
Well, I did. I wrote back to her and said, I am at work on an opera. So you asked what I'm working on now. On a new musical, not an opera, a musical, and it's called The Millionaire Who Disappeared, this very same person, and she hadn't heard of him, and I've been working on that now for 2 years.
Well, I love that. So so that's your focus right now.
That's my focus
right
now.
So there you go, Sally. This is actually something I've heard a number of the songs from. I think they're fabulous, and Orm was even, my brother Ormond was singing some the other night.
Yeah, he was,
Catchy, wonderful stuff. So basically that's what he's working on, is a musical right now. Okay, Mike Russell, one of my best friends, brothers, and karate crew, he texted me this, Dad. Mike Russell for the podcast. I think you've met him, by the way. Thank you both for being inspiring people. You're welcome, Mike. I appreciate that.
Welcome indeed.
Yep. My question to you either both is, what are the important things to let go of? What are the important things to hold on to?
Oh, that's a good one.
That's a good question. I'm taking a moment myself to ponder.
Right, indeed.
Well, let's start with important things to let go of.
To let go of, I think, past regrets, I think, or regrets about the past. I think it's important to let go of those and not let such regrets, it can be minor even, to linger on. Because certainly at my age, where there aren't many to go, why not enjoy, savor to the fullest of the moment? So I would say, in my case, that would be it. Don't look back on what could have been, what maybe even should have been.
Sure.
Just carry on right now.
Well, I like that you say that, because there are some, I made some mistakes. I have proper regrets. I have scars. I have bruises. I got bumps and tattoos. I was going to call one of my next podcasts this, and I might actually do my own thing that's about scars, regrets, bruises, and tattoos.
Yeah.
Because a life fully lived can't have no regrets. Can't have no, I wish I went left instead of right. It has to.
Yeah.
But I agree with you. We have to let them go. Because, you know, my belief, including through my addictions and all that, is that I made the best choice with the information I had at the time.
Yeah.
And if I can say that to myself, so maybe Russell, this is an idea. Like if I can say to myself, did you make the best choice with the information you had at the time? Then I never need to hang myself up if things go sideways.
Well, that's it. And why hang yourself up?
Right.
I mean, at any age you are, why hang yourself up in the past?
Right.
Use the past as a liberating force if you can somehow manage that. Tough, but if you can, why not?
Right. So, Mike, I'm going to answer both questions with one answer. And by the way, this is something I learned, and this is really fun. I'm essentially repeating some 12-step ideas, but they work for me. And I don't always go to them first. They're often the last thing I go to. But what do I need to let go of? And again, this is an idea I was given and then realized it was true for me, resentments. If I hold resentments against people, or there's an even smaller version of it called scorekeeping, you know, I lend you a grand and then you pay me back and I start wondering when you're gonna give me a grand, you know, that like scorekeeping. So it's not an overt resentment. That's not the best example, but you know what I'm getting at. The idea that I hold on to these resentments. Now, you know, you see this phrase on Instagram all the time, you're living in my head rent-free. And now my life's about this sort of construct of me as victim. And me as victim in this world doesn't do well. I'm powerless and I'm subjugated. And it's all because of things other people are doing to me. So the big one I need to let go of is resentments. But the only way I can do that is that if I have faith, and this, bear with me on this idea, my resentments usually come from the fact that things don't work out the way I want them to. Now, when things don't work out the way I want them to, that means I was attached to a goal or an outcome, and that means that you fucked me over or someone else fucked me over, or in my egoic case, the universe is so flawed that I didn't get what I deserved. Now I'm in universal oppression because of my resentments and my lack of, and this is what I need to hold on to, faith. Because my faith is that the outcome is the one it's supposed to be, or at the very least, the one that will teach me or show me the most, even if it's not what I want. So I need to let go of resentments, including scorekeeping. And the only way I can do that is if I let go of outcome. And the only way I can let go of outcome is if I have faith. That's my idea. Dad, what do you need to hold on to? What do you think of that? Or what do you think is important to hold on to?
Well, I think what's important to hold on to is the belief that you can do, that things can get better. Let me give an example. Recently, as I mentioned in these podcasts, my friend of over 60 years, Graham Gibson, died. And I've just been writing an obituary for him to be published later on. And in it, I mentioned the fact that I knew him when he was a young man in his 20s, and he seemed to be so balanced, so enjoying life from a very good family, money, all that kind of thing. And then when I finally read the completed manuscript of his first novel, not the fragments I'd seen before, I discovered the world that he was portraying there was a world of horror. Mm. It really was. Everybody in it is mangled or maimed or psychologically disturbed. And then he wrote four novels. And then when we get to the final one where I interviewed him, it was a novel called Perpetual Motion. And in that novel, it was really an apocalyptic novel in the sense it was about the fact there was millions of pigeons, passenger pigeons, at the time that the hero of this novel is living. And nowadays there are none. We destroyed them completely, the destruction of the world, in a sense. So here, on the outside, this Graham Gibson looked to be a man totally at home and comfortable in the world, and yet there was this inside nightmare world.
Sure.
Now, the thing is, he didn't let that destroy him. And that was the past, you see. He went on then to go into a different kind of thing, and that was writing prophetically about what one should do in the face of, you know, what was the end of the world. And now we are reading about that there's another 50 years before everything collapses.
Okay, so,
and so
if I may, Dad, what before you get to the point in terms of Mike's thing, what did Graham suggest? I mean, here's a guy who had an apparently dark internal life, a relatively relaxed external life, and he's writing these metaphors about, you know, ends of worlds or bad things happening. What did he suggest was the solution, either metaphorically or literally?
Literally, what we're trying now is to reverse, you know, the heating of the earth, you know, carbon
emissions.
You're talking
about that's what Graham talked about.
That's what Graham talked about. And reconnecting with nature, muzzling, somehow controlling technology, which means controlling technology in a specific case would be getting rid of dependence on fossil energies and heating, et cetera, and that.
And when was he writing about that back, though? Because he stopped writing novels a while ago.
He stopped writing novels.
Was he in the 80s or 70s? What was his...
In the
80s. When you first discovered his darkness, what were you seeing as his solutions?
His solution was to give up the novel, interestingly enough.
Oh, wow.
And to turn to... preaching, but in a very subtle way, to the world. And he gave, in other words, he sacrificed his art to try to benefit humanity around him. That's what he did.
Well, I love that.
So that's I mean.
I sometimes consider quitting acting and becoming a psychologist because I think I'd be more helpful as a person.
There you are.
Yeah.
Well, that's what he did. And so, you know, but that was a profound conviction that we're getting near the, well, as they kept saying last week with this big meeting in Madrid, we've reached the point of no return,
right,
which is frightening.
It is frightening.
And that's what he was doing all the time. And that's why he says, I'm giving up and becoming a bird watcher. And why a bird watcher? Because, again, he kept saying, birds, if you understand what's happening, they are symbols of eternity.
Well, Timothy Findley used this as well. I won't remember the name of the novel. The one set in Toronto, the birds had something called sternosemia, and they were all collapsing. I'm going to enjoy the gift of Google here. I loved this book. Timothy Findley novels. It has a red cover.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Come on, don't do me like this, Google. Headhunter,
yeah.
Yeah. That has the
right.
Birds
as
a metaphor as well.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
And of course, he wrote another one about L.A., and it was all about fire, the whole city being burned as a symbol of what he foresaw as an apocalyptic ending.
Well, sure. I mean, if this world goes away, we go away. Okay, another question for you, and this kind of came out of a discussion I had with Ormond, my brother. I've mentioned this podcast. This idea that the digital world and the internet has effectively killed time. Now, it hasn't killed the passage of time, but I can text you. We can be in the middle of a text conversation, and I can just stop, walk away, go into a meeting, come back an hour later, pick up where we left off. You can't really do that on the phone in the exact same way. But also, it doesn't matter when you watch what episode of what show. You can access equally the new episodes of The Crown or the old episodes of Remington Steele online, but you basically don't have to Tuesday night watch what's on.
Mm-hmm.
So this also goes to the idea in the newsroom. You and I talked about this, the Sorkin series, where Jeff Daniels is enjoying encyclopedias and the young businessman goes, you know, you can Google all that information.
Yeah, right.
And Jeff Daniels' wonderful response is, yeah, but you have to know what you're looking for when you Google something.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
With an encyclopedia, you can just flip it open and be presented with knowledge.
Right.
So these are a couple of vague ideas or broad ideas to come down to this question for you. In your perspective, can you have too much choice?
I don't think so. The thing is, when we say too much choice, that implies faultiness, etc. And I don't think in this case it's so that the present, the past, and the future are all bound together in some kind of, what would you say, eternal moment. That sounds like a paradox, eternal moment. But again, think of Marshall McLuhan when he had that wonderful insight it's a global village.
Right.
So the entire world, which used to be, that we couldn't even envisage what Burma, Myanmar was like. Now we can see it on the screen. We can talk to people on Skype, etc.
Oh, yeah.
So it's a total collapse of the historical past, future, and present into now, the eternal moment. And I don't think that there's too much of that. And it's the question is, can we misuse it? And that I think we can do.
How?
How? By a good example are my granddaughters, you know, Lil and Elle.
Yeah.
They are 13 years of age and they are addicts.
Yeah.
because they've got a little iPad in their hand,
yeah.
and that has strangled them, or
Absolutely.
Could strangle them, because it could inhibit their imagination. It might even be bad for their health. Who knows? So that's what I mean by...
Well, what's interesting about those devices, too, is because I think about Orm and I playing Atari when we were kids.
Yep.
2600 from Atari. The one thing about that Atari, though, is it had a location. You could only play the Atari in our den.
Right.
You couldn't play it in the back of the car on the way to South Carolina.
Exactly.
So when we were in the car on the back of the way to South Carolina, we had a different experience. But with Lily and Elle, they can be on the iPad in the den. They can be on the iPad in the back of the car. So in a weird way, you've got this bizarrely linked to... Like, you're always the same person because of your relationship to this phone, even though you're technically in different environments. Whereas back in the day, being in a different environment sort of elicited a different type of person because you had to respond differently.
Right. Well, you see, at the basis of all progress, I think, whether it's in science or in the arts, is imagination.
Yes.
And the problem with an iPad is that if you don't know how to use it, it's like a typewriter or any mechanical instrument, it may limit the imagination.
Sure. And even the idea, again, that, you know, if you flip open, like I used to go down to the library most weekends when I was younger, bike down, or go flip through your bookshelves.
Yep.
And I am being exposed to things I would never have known existed.
Yep.
Just walk down the stacks, pick a book and flip through it. Well, it's unless you have some weird random alert function set on your phone, you're only receiving information you've chosen.
Yeah.
And that's, I think, actually one of the greatest degradations of society right now,
yeah.
is what's called the echo chamber.
Yeah.
If I go to the library and I open new books, I'm constantly growing.
Yeah.
If I go to the library and they just hand me the same book every week, I am getting the exact same information every week. And that's what our Twitter feed is. That's what our Instagram feed is. That's what...
Yeah.
I actually believe looking at my phone in the back of a car instead of looking out at the new environment I'm driving through,
yep.
leads to.
Well, a very good example. One reason why one should watch how the kids use these things is Silicon Valley. I mean, there's marvelous minds down there, PhDs by the thousands, doing extraordinary stuff. They won't let their children. A survey
right.
came out and said, we control our children. They say, why? That damn thing they say is bad for them.
Right.
Now, if they say that, why would we
go
there?
Oh, it's like congressmen who won't send their kids to war.
Right.
Oh, this is a good war?
Yeah.
Then send your own fucking kid.
Yeah, right.
Oh, the health care plan's good for Americans?
Yep.
Then you have the same health care plan.
Yeah, right.
I love that point.
Yep.
If the leaders won't engage
then.
In the thing they're telling you to engage in, this is me getting mad. Don't fucking trust them, people.
Yeah.
Why would you ever trust somebody who won't drink the water they're asking
yep.
you to drink?
Exactly.
They do not have your best interests at heart.
No.
Don't vote for them.
That's
there's. I heard the great quote: "Defending rich people doesn't make you rich, idiot."
Right.
I love that.
I love that.
Because you see
too.
All these people who need social services defending the people denying them social services, but the rich people can afford private clinics.
Yep.
Anyways, you know we both feel the
yep.
same way about
uh-huh.
this. So here's a question. Again, this kind of came from Orm and I chatting, but also a Conan O'Brien. He's got a wonderful podcast and
mm-hmm.
obviously hosts Late Night for years.
Oh, yeah, I know what you mean.
Yeah. Is it important to keep learning new skills or just refine and grow what you're already kind of good at? And part of the reason we were talking about it is, you know, I'm not asking this as a 28-year-old. I'm almost 45. Orm's almost 50. As you get into what will, pardon me, Dad, start to call your dwindling years where you're on the other side of half,
yep.
how important is it to start playing guitar? Or is it more important to maybe nurture what's already in your garden? Where are you at with that? Because otherwise you're just kind of spending time. And everyone's like, start today. Just do the thing today. And it's like, yeah, do you need to? Does it matter?
I don't think... I think of my own life in which I myself really cultivated what I had, you know, tried to
right.
go the beaten path that I was on, do the things that I was best at doing to the best of my ability and so forth. On the other hand, sometimes, you don't have any choice. You know, you'll be taken by the neck and thrown in there and you have to learn. I'll give you an example. when I was approaching my 70s, I had never used a computer.
Right.
Never That's booted crazy. Up a computer. But, you know, up to that time, I had secretarial help.
Yeah.
I had a staff of three whose job was to look after me, type my stuff, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
Then, when I left the university, I'm on my own. So now, what do? I had to learn the computer. I think I started at the age of 68.
Right.
And who did I go to? I went to Mum.
Yep.
I
she
went
was great
to you.
At that. Yep.
You went to Ormond and anybody who was around. I would have gone to my granddaughters who were 7 years of age or whatever to help me and say, I got to learn this new skill,
right,
et cetera. I didn't want to, but I knew I had to.
So you don't think you'd have just gone, I'm into computers now at age 70. It was sort of out of necessity for what you were into. If I want
right.
to be, you know, word processing at the level I need to for my writing,
yep.
then this has to be part of my life.
Yes, but on the other hand, also there's the voluntary one. That was forced. There's the voluntary one. The musical I'm now writing on, it's not in the, how would I say, in the pattern of operetta
right.
or opera that I've worked in before. It's a musical.
Sure.
And that's a totally new genre.
Sure.
And so I've been teaching myself to how to write that particular thing. Now, it's still in the kind of area I was working in, but I'd go further.
Well, if I may, yeah, that's like me and my jiu-jitsu. Like,
yep.
I have a goal of
right.
at age 50. It's going to
yep.
be a tight goal, getting a black belt in jiu-jitsu. Well, that's something I started at 42, but I've been doing martial arts since I was 18.
Yeah.
It's in the area.
Yeah, right.
It's a lateral shift within
yeah.
something I've already been doing
yeah.
since I was 18.
Yeah.
I don't see that as a new interest,
no.
really.
And I don't
By
see
the way, there is a little bit of buzzing. I hope the audience doesn't mind too much. It's just some work being done
yeah.
In the condo next door. So if you're hearing that, pardon us.
Yeah.
We don't have a soundproof studio.
Yeah.
Go on, Dad, though, about the next part.
I don't think you have to learn new skills after, let's say, 50. So long as you nurture the ones that you have. And an example, just the other day in the gym here, I met this chap. He's Greek, and he does a lot of running still. He's in his 70s, and his last run was a marathon. And where did he go? He went over to Athens, literally,
yeah.
to run the marathon where it all began in Greece.
Wow.
Now, what an extension of the kinds of things he's been doing.
Well, I hope he doesn't drop dead once
no.
he delivers the news.
Well, so what? So what? There you are.
So I mean, the last part of this question is there an energetic component, whereas you're, you know, again, pardon the language, but effectively in decline and you don't have as much energy?
Yep.
And is that a conscious thing where you're like, if I've only got so much juice a day, have you found that you have less energy per day and therefore why would you disperse it?
Well, that came up in the last podcast we did, and I said that was one of the things, and I don't like regret, that I do regret. I don't have the energy that I used to. Therefore, although I've got loads of ideas that I say, oh no,
yeah.
that would take 3 years. There's no point in starting that.
Right.
For instance,
okay.
there's a novel I'd like to write, but no, I don't have the energy to do that novel, so I know it's impractical.
Great. So let's come back to our opening here, because I want to pivot into another discussion we've been having. Name two more movies for me that people should watch, because it's not just The Red Shoes. Younger
well,
people, maybe something they haven't heard of. What do you
well,
like? If you don't watch this, you're missing out.
Well, I would say the one completely different from The Red Shoes I mentioned before is the wonderful Gone with the Wind.
Right.
I think Gone with the Wind, there one could have certain problems with it, but it's a great, great movie. Fantastic sweep to it. The American Civil War.
Uh-huh.
Wonderful actors of that period. You know, Clark Gable, who was the name at the time. And who was the English actress, you know, who, I mean,
Vivian
Lee, who was a brilliant
yep,
actor.
Olivia Hallowan,
yep,
Leslie Howard.
Yeah, all of those
Clark
people.
Gable.
So it was a great one. Spent a lot of money on it. It was based on a wonderful story
yeah.
Made for film. So that was a wonderful movie, I think, with great characters,
etc. So people should watch
so
Gone with the Wind.
I'll give you one more. There's one that not so well known, but I think is a brilliant movie. It's called M.
Yeah.
Written by a fellow called, I think it was, no, directed by Murnau.
Okay.
He was a German director, and it takes place in Berlin, and in that he's a murderer, and it's the story of a man who's murdered children. Okay. And so Berlin sets out to catch M. And there was a guy called Peter Lorre,
yep.
who I don't know that name for people who know film well, and he was a brilliant actor, and so he played the lead in that sort of thing. And that is a movie I'd recommend.
Okay, great.
Detective story, horror, brilliant, brilliant movie indeed.
Right on. Okay, so the you know, I wasn't baiting, I was just actually genuinely curious. But the idea of Gone with the Wind, let's say, that's a historical fiction.
Yep.
So let's pop into what you and I have been talking about. The Crown. You just watched The Crown.
Right.
I just watched The Crown. So I think we share the same opinion. Now, I'll say what I think that opinion is, because I think we share it. And if you haven't seen it, there's no spoilers here. But I far prefer seasons one and two. And the reason for me is twofold. I actually, on a whole, prefer the first two seasons cast, even though everyone does a wonderful job in the third season. Mm-hmm. But I also felt that I was watching almost a soap opera, because these things weren't historically accurate. They took way more license with season three with the truth of what was happening to create more drama within the series. Am I accurate that that's how we both perceived it a bit?
Absolutely. I totally agree.
Right. And by the way, to the listener, we didn't watch this together. This was just independent. But my dad called me after around episode eight. And again, I don't want to disparage any of the cast, because I think I don't publicly condemn performances, because we're all doing our best. But we kind of agreed on who we liked or didn't compared to season one. But in terms of the stories, yeah, there was definitely, they were playing fast and free. How important is it to stick to any kind of authenticity when you're making a show like The Crown or a film like Gone with the Wind? Does it matter?
Well, that's a good question. Because we also had just when you came this morning,
I've got this written down too.
We were talking about The Irishman,
yep.
And you see, the thing is, when you're watching these shows, and I think directors have must face this and think, they must question it. The writers do too, etc. But poetic license extends so far, and if you are, how would I say, cheating the audience by having two lines of narratives going on in a movie. One, you are giving a straightforward historical account, which the director is putting up maybe even notices or speeches saying, this is fact.
Right.
And then you've got another line of the story, which is not saying anything, but it's being presented as fact. Then not only is there confusion perhaps in the viewer's mind, or maybe he isn't confused at all because he's not aware of which is fact or which is fiction, but somebody who's knowledgeable about film has some sense of history, they would be saying, there's cheating going on here.
Sure.
It's not authentic, or just to turn around bluntly and say, it's dishonest.
So do you think that, so you did think, let's say, The Irishman was dishonest?
I thought it was dishonest in certain ways. For example, Jimmy Hoffa, it's one of the mysteries, what happened to Jimmy Hoffman. And so these guys turn around who are directing the film and they say, how do we solve this? I say, okay, we'll just burn them up so they haven't cremated. There's absolutely no evidence to support that.
Right.
When you turn to The Crown, you go along, and much of it is, of course, historically accurate. But then they will take liberties that have absolutely nothing to do with the truth.
Yeah.
But they would turn around and justify it and say, poetic license. And you say, that is not poetic license. Poetic license, in a sense, is heightening what is already there, but it's not a new line of narrative.
But see, here's what's interesting, Dan, is in The Irishman, that guy claims that's what happened.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So if you're going to tell the story of Frank Sheeran, he says that's what happened. So even though we don't know, and by the way, some scholars have debunked it, but if you're going to tell his story, it's not inaccurate to tell what he says happened, even if it's not true. What do you think of that?
Well, then that's what you call the unreliable narrator.
And which, by the way, I often hate. Let me rail quickly. I've done this on my last podcast. The Usual Suspects with Kevin Spacey, it's the biggest fucking cheat of a movie that got all these accolades for being so clever. I don't care if I spoil it. Kevin Spacey's character tells us what happens. And then we realized Kevin Spacey was lying. Yeah. That's the whole thrust of the twist.
I know.
But he's the narrator, or not the narrator, but he's walking us through what happened. And then we're given the visual of what he's describing. It's the biggest cheat that everyone went, wow, that's so cool. I'm like, no, because if we, the viewer, don't have the chance to uncover what's happening, then we're just being cheated through the unreliable narrator.
Right.
I hated that.
The unreliable narrator can be very effective, but the reader has to be allowed in to realize that we are watching this character, and he may be telling the truth, he may not, and sorting that out is part of the aesthetic of the movie, not a director just pulling off some cheap stunt.
Sure, I don't feel that way about The Irishman, though, because that's a real guy who believes that's his story, and as such, the even the CGI not working totally for me, because it didn't, it can be seen through the gauze of memory, and as such, you know, the discontinuity between the face and then De Niro's body when he's kicking someone. I had forgiveness for it.
There's another thing that can happen is, there's another thing you see in the Irishman that, you know, we're talking, I'm talking about the dishonesty of some of the historical detail.
Sure.
Is that then if you stay with the straight storyline, you've got to then give some justification. I'm thinking of the scene in the bar where Sheeran sees this waitress come over.
Yeah.
He looks at her, she looks at him, gives him a come on sign, etc. And the next thing is, he's divorced, married her.
Yeah.
Now at that point, I say to the writer, the director, now wait a minute. I mean, historically this is true, but you just can't ram history down and say, because it said biographically that was so. There's got to be dramatic justification for that. There, aesthetic justification.
See, it's so funny where I disagree with you on this because, and again, I want to keep this within The Irishman, but also broadly speaking in terms of story. We know that that's not what the story's about.
Yep.
We know that that happens and happened. And so, now, the other discussion is what the fuck with the women in that movie, but that's valid. But the movie's not about him leaving his first wife and meeting the second. So I don't need any time on that. And in fact, that's what I think Scorsese's a bit of a master at, which is he just goes, and then this happened, and now we're here.
And I never object to that, because I think that film can do that, the jump can happen. It's wonderful, wonderful. But in that, you're presented with a happy family to that point, and then suddenly you get another woman, you say, well, why?
Right.
Why is that an integral part of the story? If it's not, leave it out,
but
historically.
It's a factual part of the story, but it's not integral.
It's not integral.
Right, so we've got to keep up with what's happening in his life, but it's not integral to what we're watching.
No. Oh, I see. Okay. Well, maybe
that's where I go with it.
Yeah, okay. Fair enough.
Because now, if you don't agree that's the case, then you would want more of that. If you do agree, then let's just get on to the next part of the story.
I feel that it's totally unnecessary. I think, you see, Scorsese doesn't know what to do with women, generally speaking. Certainly in this one.
Sure.
The women have no role. All they do is look admiringly, generally speaking.
Yeah.
And the worst case is the daughter in The Irishman. What's her name?
Paquin.
Yeah. She's a good actress,
she's phenomenal.
And what happened to her? She just says nothing. Anyway.
Yeah, no, even her face is so expressive. Oh, yeah. I'd love to work with her. By the way, it's funny because when I was shooting my first film, K-19, it was directed by Kathryn Bigelow, who, by the way, went
wonderful director.
Wonderful director.
Marvelous.
I was blown away to be on that movie because Point Break is non-ironically my current favorite movie. It's surpassed Singing in the Rain, the original with Keanu Reeves and Patrick Swayze.
Mm-hmm.
She directed it, but also went on to become the first woman to win an Oscar.
Yep.
So I was lucky enough to work with her. And in any case, she, after about 3 weeks of the Russian, it was a Russian submarine movie, the Russian submarine expert, who'd been a captain, that kind of thing, or still was, I suppose, he'd be like, Catherine, this is not accurate. They would never do this with one another.
Yep.
And so she'd always try and listen, always try and listen. Then after about 3 weeks, she goes, I'm paraphrasing, I don't give a fuck. It's not interesting that way. This is how we're going to do it. And as long as it's not egregious, he's like, it's not egregious, it's just not accurate. She's like, I'm good with it. And I actually agreed with her, because I'm not watching a documentary of Russian submariners. And sometimes I need to go with the fact that, yes, the Neil deGrasse Tyson of submarines will go, well, in fact, the constellations above the submarine that night are inaccurate. I believe that even happened with Titanic.
Yep.
but in which I, ironically or not, was directed by her ex-husband James Cameron,
right? Exactly.
Who then I believe went back and fixed it,
because
he wanted it to be accurate. The point is that if it drives the story forward, I don't need it to be mired in utter truth.
Oh, I agree with that absolutely. Now you're talking.
But for some reason, it bothered me in The Crown.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
It felt like I was watching. I may as well just have watched Downton Abbey.
Well, I mean, if you think of The Crown, that scene with Margaret in Washington with President
Johnson.
No, it wasn't Johnson.
Wasn't it?
Maybe Johnson. It was Johnson. You're right, it was LBJ, yeah. Right? I mean, it was total nonsense. They've been the foulness of her language and all that sort of thing. Privately, she had a foul tongue, but never happened in the White House. Now, by the way, your Russian captain that you're talking about on your movie, I met him. I was on the set.
I remember you meeting him, Sergei.
As we're walking along,
lovely guy.
Chatting with him, well, it may have been. And so
may have been lovely or may have been...
yes,
I got along well with him. How about that?
Oh, yeah. Well, let me put it this way. You can decide after I tell you the story. And so we're chatting about this and that, and he was telling me what he was doing and that she would ignore him type of thing.
Right.
What you're just saying just now. So, and I said, well, so it's difficult working with her. He said, what does a woman know about submarines?
Yeah,
he said,
fuck
she knows nothing about that
like
sort of thing.
Anymore.
And he had a terrible opinion of women.
Of course
women.
He did.
He really had. I mean, and I felt it was saying, now, the other one, the Canadian guy who was also an advisor, he was
I think his name was Doug. I can't remember.
And he was a captain, right?
Yeah.
Et cetera.
Okay, are you going to pull the sheets off on him? Because I loved him
too. No, he was okay.
Okay.
He was, but the Russian guy, there's contempt for Catherine
was
dreadful.
He's out of my books. Because I'm going to guess he hasn't changed his opinion, but I will give everyone the benefit of the doubt. Okay. So before we get into my last bigger question, how important is trivial knowledge these days? Because, you know, you have a wonderful database, even with a hint of decline in your memory. You remember who acted in what movie, what year, what war, what happened in the 12th century better than anyone I know.
Yeah.
And I grew up valuing that. So when I would go to summer camp, I would have a massively broad trivial base. I was on Reach for the Top. But none of it matters now because we have Google. So my mental hard drive, does it need to store what year Moira Shearer was in the Red Shoes? Mm-hmm. Or do I just go, I don't care because I can look it up in 2 seconds? How important is trivia?
I think it's important to whether it's trivia or just general knowledge, because you got to know what to look for.
Right.
And if you don't remember what to look for, how do you look for it? I'm thinking of the memoir which I've just written, you know, The Symmetry of the Tiger.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a lot of
available
stories in
on
there.
Available on Amazon and in some of your local bookstores, everybody. Symmetry of the Tiger, Tiger with a Y.
Yeah, right, a memoir. Anyway, in that there's all sorts of stuff dating back over 90 years.
Right.
And that I couldn't get that out of Google. It has to be in my memory. All those little links that provide the narrative that was my life story. Now, I mean, certainly in some things I can go to Google to say, oh, is that date that I'm thinking is there, etc. But the warmth and woof of that novel, or that memoir, I can't get that anyway.
This is interesting. Let's say I'm writing my memoir.
Yep.
And let's say I just go, yeah, I feel like writing it. I'm 44. I'm going to write a memoir. Yep. And I go back in 1988 when Guns N' Roses released Appetite for Destruction.
Yep.
Well, they didn't. They released it in 87, but it only popped in 88.
Yep.
So my memory of Guns N' Roses in 1988 is accurate, but the release date is wrong.
Yep.
Does that matter if I'm writing a piece of memory?
Not really. But it's good if you sort of see, I'll check that date in Google. That could be useful to check your memory to see whether you've got it accurate, because the memory, you may have a general memory of it. And if you want to say, yeah, I'd like to be absolutely sure, then you check.
See,
otherwise, you don't need that.
I had a moment, I'll tell you about 5 years ago, maybe longer. I was living with Emily at the time, and I walked in the house and I said, have you seen my sunglasses, after about 5 minutes? And she said, no. And I said, okay, well, I looked down as I was opening the door and saw them hanging from my shirt. So they're in the house. That memory was as clear as a bell. And we looked around the house, couldn't find them. I went out to the car and they were in the car. Now, I would have bet $1 million that I saw them hanging down from my shirt as I opened the door. It was wrong.
Yeah.
That day, I literally accepted that my memory is so inaccurate that it doesn't even matter to try and make it accurate. Because 2 minutes earlier, I'd pictured something that wasn't true.
Yeah.
Now, I'm not insane. I don't hear voices. But I think we can all relate to the idea that you could have sworn something was true. And then later, right. It's like, yeah, no, the keys weren't blah, blah, blah.
Yeah,
Doesn't matter.
Doesn't matter. Yeah, you see, if you were in
especially
your memory.
As long as I don't defend it. It matters if you start fighting with your partner and going, no, what I said is right.
Yeah.
Because you might be wrong.
Well, you see, you're now at the question of truth. And that is the thing. Pilate said the trial of Jesus.
Mm-hmm.
He said, what is truth? Pilate said. And then he went out and said, I can find no guilt in this man that we are trying. But what is truth is a very difficult one. And that's a whole area that we could explore some other time. But it seems now that there is no standard for truth now. I'm thinking of Trump in America. 50% of the population say this guy's great. 50% say he's not. What's the truth?
I think there is a standard for truth in terms of facts. And I just think people choose to ignore it.
Well, that is true. Why do they? And that is exactly what
because
the other
they're a fucking cult.
The other half says the other. Well, you're talking about millions and millions of people, including, professors, scientists, Nobel Prize winners.
How many people
admirals.
Followed Hitler? And I'm not likening exactly. Trump to Hitler that way, but can't deny he's a cult of personality.
Exactly. But I mean, on things such as facts, what you and I would call facts, the truth, did he, instigate? The inquiries to try and get the Bidens involved in the scandal in Ukraine. What are the facts on that?
No, I agree that there's nuanced when there isn't black and white. But there's black and white where he'll tweet, climate change is a hoax created by China, and then say, I didn't say that.
Yep.
Anybody who doesn't clock that he just lied is choosing the cult of personality over facts. There are facts. And times where, I don't even want to make this about Trump, where someone or a thing is wrong. And I feel like we've lost as a culture the ability to go, hey, you're fucking wrong.
I know.
And even on acting sets, everyone comes up and goes, it's perfect. I love what you're doing. I love it. Maybe try it a little more like this. And I'm just like, just tell me what to do. Just black and white what your next note is.
I don't agree with you totally because I think there may be, and I'm thinking about this recently a great deal because of the whole Trump business and others involved, that Brexit, for instance, with Johnson over there, that is there, Einstein with his relativity theory.
Sure.
Notice relativity.
Right.
Are we now at the stage where you've got relativity even as regards truth? Critical theory, there's a thing called reader response theory, which says that the meaning of a novel is what you think about it, you, Sean Benson, not what anybody else thinks about it.
And well, yeah, but that's right.
And that's your personal truth.
I actually agree with that. Bob Dylan was a big proponent of that, where people would say, what did you mean here? And he goes, I wrote it, man. You figure it out.
Yeah, I know. But the thing is, if you figure out and you say, I think the novel is about this, and then somebody else says, no, it's about this, and somebody else... Is there one interpretation or is it all relative?
Well, here's the thing, though, is that with something interpretive, it doesn't matter. Mm-hmm. You can interpret that however you want. Because who cares? But when we're talking about facts relating to... Look, everybody who denies climate science relies on every other kind of science to drive across a bridge.
Right.
Engineering science to break their car, the science of friction. But then when 11,000 scientists, 0% dissent that we're in a man-made state of climate crisis, all of a sudden they don't care about science anymore. Mm-hmm. These are people who are ignoring facts. Now look, is the fact when people say in 12 years the world ends? No, that's not true. That's a paraphrased version of the science, which says in 12 years we'll reach a tipping point at which there'll be no turning back.
Yep.
But it's also the parenthetical is based on everything we know.
Yeah, I think that conversation can come up in a later podcast.
The whole thing about it.
Yeah, cool. We got a lot of stuff there.
I get excited by this idea because I think there are like. There are the idea of a priori facts. 1 + 1 is 2.
Yeah.
Whether you believe it or not, if you take one object and another object, there's now 2 objects. Whatever you name them, the idea is that the number of objects is still two, or whatever language or concept you want to have, but there's still what we call two of those. And that's what I think is being ignored by cultists.
Right. But the only problem is that in truth, when it comes to a fact, let's say that what we're talking about now, the Ukraine business, there are so many shades in there.
Shades in there.
Shades, nuances, and that people can seize on one. I mean, there was interference by Ukraine, not on a state level, but many Ukrainians wanted Hillary Clinton to win. And that is not to be disputed. They
right.
did. But there wasn't a state sponsorship, and that's what we're talking about.
Right.
And as soon as those situations are clouded, then you've got the problem of that the people say, but I read it and so.
Yeah.
But what they don't realize is we're talking about individuals rather than a state manipulation, as with the Trump,
yes.
which is state manipulation.
Correct. And I agree that there are gray areas where if I say to you, hey, do me a favor, and everyone goes, we know what he meant, I get to go prove it.
Yeah, that's it.
You know, and that's that is where that is going to be a gray and slippery slope.
Yeah, right.
Last idea then, Dad, because I don't know that we need to come back to that. I feel like that's part of one of our through lines in our ongoing conversation.
Exactly.
So we'll touch on that again. Listener, hold tight for the continuance of that one. Okay, longtime listener, first time questioner. You have easily one of the best understandings of World War II. Mm-hmm. And all we've talked about this briefly in the podcast, all the battles, all of the offensives, all of the thinking, all of the enigma, the Bletchley, the whole deal. But the other thing that you have, Dad, is that you're one of the few people who have that breadth of knowledge who also lived it.
Mm-hmm.
Like there's a modern day scholar who probably knows more than you, but wasn't there for it.
Yeah.
Didn't hear Churchill on the radio gathered around with the family. You know, didn't have the house bombed and hide behind the couch and all that. And then there's somebody who back then knew more, but they're dead. So do you feel any kind of responsibility to bring that to bear, or are we doing it with this podcast? It seems like that was a hobby of yours. Does it matter, or is that just something you enjoyed that goes to the grave with you? Your perspective on that.
That will go to the grave with me, although you have heard me, and Ormond has heard me talking about it time and time again. For example, I think one of the great injustices of books about the Second World War and the media coverage of the Second World War, not by the experts, but generally speaking, is that Russia's part in the Second World War is generally ignored for the very obvious reason it became an enemy after it was our friend, our ally. And it was the Russians who broke the back of the German armies. The German armies were incredible in their science, in what they were doing. I'm not talking about the atrocities associated with, but purely
their
in terms of tactics, military skill, strategy, all
they're
that kind
engineers,
of thing.
Man. They know how to build something.
Their tanks, their guns, I mean, they were extraordinary. But it was the Russians who broke them. And they had battles in which more people were lost by the Russians than lost by the Allies in the entire war, by all the Allies combined.
In single battles.
In single battles. And that has never been truly acknowledged, because our knowledge of the Second World War for my generation and many of them after was clouded by and mirrored by the media, mainly film. And in film, it was the Americans, by and large, who did it. There's a wonderful example, grotesque in a way, called Burma, !! In which Errol Flynn, with an American group, liberates Burma. The Americans were never fighting in Burma.
They just made it up.
They made it up. The British were so angry about it, they wouldn't allow the film for years to be shown. So you see what I mean? They say to the victors, fall the spoils, and they write history.
Yeah.
Now, the Russians didn't have that worldwide reach of the media in North America, e.g. Hollywood and New York, and also in Western Europe. And so it was covered by them largely. Now,
was their decision in many ways, yeah, right? Because they right. shut off and basically created the curtain.
Oh yeah. And I mean, that's not to praise Russia. I mean, the poor Russian people have suffered the most dreadful forms of repression from the Tsars on. There hasn't been a good government there. The poor Russians suffer so deeply, deeply from their leadership.
And interesting note, Mom was born in what's now Russia.
Yeah, indeed, yes.
So to the listener, my mother was born in Kaliningrad, now it's Kaliningrad, yeah, and her town is called Zovatsk. Yeah. But at the time, it was East Prussia, and she was born in Tilsit near Königsberg. Yeah. And then it's this weird little piece over there, right? It's not even joined by land with the rest of Germany.
That's right. It's up there in the east. Yeah. It's up in East Prussia. Cool. Yeah. Yeah. It is joined by land, East Germany. It was. Oh, yeah.
Are you sure?
Yeah. It was Danzig that was not joined. Danzig was cut off. Yeah.
I must have been looking at the wrong shifting map of those times.
We can check that.
We can check the map after. But in any case, my actual bloodline heritage is closer to someone from Russia or Lithuania than somebody, let's say, from, Hohenheim in Germany.
Absolutely.
Especially over by the West.
Absolutely. Yeah. Your grandfather, Nicky, he was Lithuanian,
right?
That's our background, whole
hundreds
background.
Of years of... Yeah. That's pretty cool. Yeah. Well, I think we'll leave it there, Dad. Anything you want to put a capper on?
No. I think we've been magnificent. I think we'll leave it there.
I think we have been magnificent. We listen back to our podcast, so we praise ourselves for how much better we're getting at this as we ease into the chat of it all. I hope you're enjoying it too, everybody. And then, as always, I'll post when it's time for us to do another one, and you can ask us all your scintillating questions. Thanks, everybody.
Bye-bye.